That'd be great.
This meeting is now being recorded.
Hello.
Sounds good. Well, thank you very much. So you know, and that was Sean.
Yeah, hi, this is Bill. Sean had to leave, so we're waiting for people. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So that's interesting. I can also I was prepared. That was great. I was also prepared to start the recording. I can end the recording from where I am.
Okay, that's great. So, Harley, how about we give it a few more minutes?
I have just now 11 o'clock. I usually wait until about 2 minutes after the hour.
Hey, Mike. helping Harley. He got caught. He got caught in traffic.
Oh, yeah. It was, and I'm sure the folks who may be listening to this recording. Oh, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to stop the recording. We're going to chit-chat a little bit longer and then start the recording again.
Okay.
No, wait. Oh, I'm sorry. Now, the way this thing stops the recording is it hangs up on everybody. Let's not do that.
I don't have the passcode.
I do. I've got the codes here. I caught myself just in time.
Okay. I guess I get to sit here in the front. Yeah, it's a sparse crowd, but I think there's another seminar.
What?
Is there another seminar?
There's one at noon. Is there another one right now?
Usually not.
Okay, let's start in about 30 seconds.
Okay, that's fine here. I'm all set up. It helps, yeah.
And I will go in, and I also, as I'm going to ask everybody else to do other than Lawrence, go on mute because although I pulled over to a nice little neighborhood, there's occasional trucks that go by.
Okay. So where were you coming from, Harley?
Well, I live in Alexandria. Stopped off for what was intended to be picking up a quick prescription from a doctor, and then was going to get back on the Beltway. But it took me 90 minutes to get to the doctor's, and my little GPS navigation says it's going to take me 90 minutes to get to Goddard. So just shy of 3 hours to go 25 miles from Alexandria to Goddard.
That's not true. Yeah, that's a lot.
Okay, tell you what. I think everybody's ready, so let's begin. Thank you all very much. We're really pleased that Lawrence Roth is staying up late in either Switzerland or Sweden. There's a little embarrassing story at my expense on that. Speaking to us today about Europa's atmosphere and plumes through ultraviolet observations. A quick note, the reason that I invited Lawrence to speak today is that he gave an outstanding presentation this past spring on approximately the same topic. At the 25th anniversary of the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope. It was well worth having folks hear him again, or have folks who didn't hear him have a chance to hear him out. So, the floor is yours. If everybody else would please mute your phones, unless you're going to ask Lawrence a question. And Lawrence, from time to time, so the floor is yours, and from time to time, if you would note to folks online, what page number you're on. So,
yes.
Lawrence, the floor is yours.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much, and thank you very much for the invitation in the first place. I was asked to give a short outline of my career so far. I graduated in Cologne, Germany, with Joachim Sauer, who is also here on my co-author list, And after that, I went on to work at Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, Texas, with Kurt Rutherford and the UV group there. And before I did an internship at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore with Daryl Strobel and Paul Putman, so they are all in the co-author list. And now, at the moment, I am again a postdoc at the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden, in the plasma physics group. So one thing before I start, there are also constructions here just outside my window, and I was hoping, I was actually expecting that they are done by 5 p.m., which it is now in Stockholm, but surprisingly they are still working, and they build a new building, and they blow up the rock in the ground here. So I hope they don't do this anymore this time, but if you hear a loud blast, it's from the constructions outside. So back to the topic, I'm happy to talk about Europa's atmosphere and plumes through UV eyes, and in particular I will present our Hubble previous and our Hubble observations of Europa. So next slide, I have to go on myself. A short outline of my presentation today. I will introduce Europa, Jupiter's moon Europa, briefly in the beginning, and mention that Europa is very topical, also because we have upcoming space missions to the moons of Jupiter. And after that, I will talk about the HSC observations that led to the discovery first of Europa's global atmosphere, and later on to the detection of H2O plume emissions. And in the end, I will present more recent results from Hubble and talk about future prospects, about future missions to the Jupiter system, and also possible observing ideas with a future space telescope from Earth. So we are at Jupiter. We are at the largest planet in the solar system with the largest planetary magnetic field, and with these four large so-called Galilean moons. And what you can see here is a very famous sketch that shows the four moons, and the magnetic field is here in the light blue dipolar lines. And because the axis of this dipole moment of Jupiter is slightly tilted with respect to the rotational axis of Jupiter, and so is the equatorial plane of the dipole field, of course, and also the equatorial plane of the plasma torus, of the plasma sheet in Jupiter's magnetosphere, these moons are constantly exposed to a variable plasma and magnetic field environment during this fast rotation of Jupiter in 10 hours, which then in the end leads to a constantly changing orientation of the magnetic field and density of the plasma. And so the innermost moon is Io, and then the second innermost moon is Europa, still deep in this huge magnetosphere of Jupiter, where the plasma almost or completely rigidly co-rotates with the planet. This is a beautiful mosaic of Europa showing the unique surface with very few craters, but instead we have these long cracks all over the surface that you find globally. We have some areas that are more contaminated, some areas are almost pure water ice, and the very young appearance and the lack of craters always suggested that there might be a global liquid ocean inside Europa. But the geological evidence was never 100% that we actually have liquid water still today, because also convective ice could explain the resurfacing processes and just liquid water in the past. But we do have evidence that even today a liquid water ocean exists at Europa from the magnetometer measurements of the Galileo probe, which showed that we have an electrically conductive material inside the moon, which only can be a salty water ocean about a few tens of kilometers to 100 kilometers below this icy, this rigid icy crust. And in the case of Europa, this liquid or liquid ocean is thought to be connected directly to the interior, to the mantle of the moon, which allows things like hydrothermal vents to be present at the bottom of this liquid ocean. So an interaction process between mantle bringing to this ocean a certain chemistry and also providing a heat source. So Europa is really one of the top candidates to provide all the ingredients that we think are necessary to for life to evolve. And that's why Europa is so interesting and also special, because of these special conditions also compared to other moons that also might have oceans, like the neighboring moon Ganymede. But already at Ganymede, we think the ocean is sandwiched between ice layers. But Europa really might be like an ice shell above an active ocean floor. And also because the moon is relatively large compared to other bodies, it can retain this possibly life-friendly environment for a larger time period. So we have really a stable environment where things can evolve over the necessary time periods. And in the upcoming years, we have several missions going to Jupiter and also Europa. First, there is the Juno mission arriving in Jupiter next year, but Juno is dedicated to study Jupiter's magnetic fields and atmosphere, and not so much the moons. So it's really, there will be no close flybys at Europa or anything. It's really dedicated to the planet itself. But then we have two other missions. One is ESA's Jupiter Icy Moon Explorer, the JUICE mission, which will have 11 instruments on board, and the launch is probably going to be in 2022, and arrival then about 7.5 years later. And this mission will, after about 3 years in orbit around Jupiter, will actually go into orbit around Ganymede to study Ganymede really closely, and the magnetic field and of Ganymede. But before, we will have two close flybys at Europa at an altitude of a few hundred kilometers, where it will be possible to study with these 11 instruments, Europa in particular. But even more exciting for Europa, so to say, is of course NASA's planned Europa multi-flyby mission, where the instruments, this suite of instruments, of 9 instruments, was just selected this year. And they also have ambitious plans with a possible launch date also in 2022 or maybe a few years later. And depending on the launch system, it might be a very direct trajectory to the Jupiter system, which could take the spacecraft there in not much more than 2 years, or possibly in a more common trajectory, which then would be 7 years. So, but in the most optimistic case, the spacecraft could be there at Jupiter already in 2025, which is only 10 years from now. And the objectives for Europa of this multi-flyby mission are the following. So the overall goal is of course to explore Europa's habitability. And then there are four more specific objectives. One is the ice shell and the ocean. We want to characterize the ice shell thickness and the thickness of the underlying water and the heterogeneity and the ocean properties like salinity. And then, of course, another very important aspect is the chemistry, the composition of both the ocean and the underlying and the surface, the ice surface above, and the geology, the unique geology of Europa's surface. And then there's one reconnaissance objective for a future lander, which is always the long-term goal for Europa, I think, but a very, very costly a very costly mission would be a lander for Europa, and this multi-flyby mission could characterize sites where a future mission could land. That could be interesting. Like, of course, we don't want to land in a boring, like, inactive play. So we rather want to be close to liquid water than in some interesting active area. So these are the mission objectives and the future missions, but that's why Europa is really topical at the moment. But now I come to the second part, and so we're coming back from all this future stuff to the past Hubble observations, and in particular the observations that led to the discovery of the O2 atmosphere and the water plumes. It's was a spectrum from the Goddard High Resolution spectrograph that revealed emissions here. That's the first FUV spectrum you see on slides. I'm sorry, I should probably mention the slides more often. Slide 9 are we now, and the spectrum to the lower left here was the first FUV spectrum published by Hall et al. In 95, and it showed emissions, atmospheric emissions at the 1356 angstrom line and the 1304 angstrom line, and the specific ratio of these, of the brightness of these two lines, with the 1356 forbidden transition being brighter than the allowed 1304 transition, indicated that electron impact dissociative excitation of O2 produces these emissions, because laboratory measurements showed that the excitation of O2 produces more emission at the forbidden line here, and this is consistent with the spectra of Europa's atmospheric emissions. And to the right, you see a sketch of what's going on. So we have the atmosphere is generated by sputtering, so energetic ions hit the ice surface, and then there's radiolysis, and O2 escapes, just like H2O is also sputtered, but H2O freezes in contact with the surface, and the sticking coefficient, so the refreezing coefficient for O2 is almost zero, so it builds a surface-bound, very tenuous atmosphere or exosphere at Europa. And the observed emissions are excited by electrons also from the magnetosphere that collide with this tenuous O2 atmosphere. And so next slide, slide 10. And later on, with the STIF camera on Hubble, we had the first images of just these oxygen emissions. And I show an image here at the right-hand side, top slide 10, of the 1356 emission, oxygen 1356 angstrom emission. And the first campaign revealed an irregular emission pattern. And it was not clear from the beginning how these or where these irregularities came from. And one possibility is just an inhomogeneous electron excitation. So you have more hot electrons exciting the emissions here in the upper right quadrant of the disk. Or, of course, you might have an atmospheric inhomogeneity with more higher neutral density. And the first time this idea was followed was in a paper by Sauer et al. In 2011. They had ACS observations and a slight surplus of emission at a longitude of 90 degrees west, and compared this to estimations for shear stresses on fractures, and found a coincidence suggesting that it might be possible that like a surplus of neutral gas produces such a surplus in the auroral emissions that are observed by Hubble. And after this ACS campaign, where ACS was actually only used because this was not available at that time, but this was repaired later on during the service mission 4 in May 2009. And so we, after that, we were able to use this again to look at these UV emissions from Europa. And just, this is a very simplified sketch on slide 11 of the imaging spectroscopy that you can do with STIS and the moons of Jupiter, because the widest slit for STIS here, 2 arcsecond wide slit, is just wider than the size of the moons in the sky. So Europa is about 1 arcsecond more or less, and so you can image the entire disk of Europa and then do spectroscopy to look at the different wavelengths, like the oxygen emissions. And on the next slide, slide 12, there is such a observing image with this in the G140L mode, and three specific lines are of interest that are observed here in this mode. That's the two oxygen emissions at 1304 and 1356 angstrom, and then there's also the hydrogen lime alpha line in this spectral range. And so above, so the blue panel, the blue spectrum shows the trace and the spectral image, and below is the derived spectrum where we fit a reflected sunlight in dotted red here to the solar continuum at wavelengths above 150 nanometers and subtract this, and you can see that the measured signal in black is higher clearly at the oxygen emissions, so there's atmospheric emissions, while the Lyman alpha is mostly consistent with just surface reflected sunlight. But we had then two more observing campaigns in November and December 2012, and then what we expected was, okay, we see probably mostly auroral emissions with a brighter 1356 line because O2 is the main atmospheric constituent, and you might see some fluorescence at the 1304 oxygen line or even Lyman alpha, and this image triplet here obtained in December 2012 then showed something else. It showed a, after subtraction of the reflected sunlight, it showed this emission surplus at the hydrogen lime alpha line near the South Pole, and a smaller but still spatially coincident emission surplus at the one oxygen line at 1304 angstrom, and no measurable surplus at the other oxygen line. And the specific ratio of these emission surpluses was exactly consistent with electron impact dissociative excitation of water vapor, because we found like 500 to 600 Rayleigh sphere Lyman alpha, and then like 25 to 30 Rayleigh surplus in the 1304 line, and not much surplus, or I mean not measurable, in the 1356 line, and that's what has been seen in laboratory measurement of electron collisions with H2O.
Hi, so, excuse me. Can I ask a question? I don't want to interrupt the flow. This is Jennifer Wiseman. I'm the Hubble project scientist, and I'm very interested in this result. But I don't quite understand how you spatially discerned that this emission is on one side of the moon when the entire moon is fitting into the Stiss slit. Can you explain that?
So how we can separate the spatial regions across the moon, or
right when the entire moon is basically sitting inside the Stiss slit, so you're basically, even your spectroscopy is pulling in the emission from the entire disk of the moon. How did you discern that this particular emission is coming only from one side?
Okay, yeah, we do have a good spatial resolution within the slit. So the slit is about 2 arcseconds wide, and it's resolved by 80 pixels on the detector, and probably like 50, 60 resolution elements. So that's the resolution we have. We have like 40 detector pixels across Europa, and
okay, that's what I meant. So you actually have 40 pixels across Europa. That's terrific. Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay, thank you.
Yeah, and so that was interesting. And then what we did here with this December observations, which were taken over 5 Hubble orbits, we looked at the 5 individual exposures taken in each orbit, and we found that, I mean, even though in these individual images the signal is not statistically significant anymore, but we still do see some emission, especially at the Lyman alpha light, and from this region constantly over the 5 orbits, and this spatial persistency kind of supports the atmospheric inhomogeneity, because in these five Hubble orbits, which correspond to about 7 hours. The plasma environment, which also creates an inhomogeneity, is highly variable and would lead to like moving blocks maybe, but not a spatially persistent surplus in one local area here. And comparing or deriving from the brightness, from the derived brightness, a column abundance of water, we found that, that something like assuming very simplified parameters for the plasma environment, that it corresponds to about 10 to the 20 H2O molecules in a column per square meter. And so in one slide, now slide 14, in one slide, so the this image triplet kind of suggests the presence of something like this as drawn here in this artist's picture. And then the question was, we had three observations, and only in one of the observations we saw this emission surplus. So at the same time it was first published that the plumes of Saturn's moon Enceladus, so we can go to next slide 15, they are temporally variable, and it was shown that Enceladus plumes are more active when the moon is near apocenter and less active near pericenter, which is here nicely sketched on slide 15. And surprisingly or interestingly, with our small statistics, by then, of three images, it matched the same pattern because we had three images. And so if you click on slide 16 and then you click one more time, you see the three images from October 99, November 2012, December 2012, where two were at pericenter, one at apocenter. So we did a fast repetition of observations at apocenter early in 2014. If you click on slide 16, I'm still on slide 16, like now we have five images of the two diagnostic lines, and it did not confirm like this simple pattern that we always see emissions like this at epicenter when Europa is at epicenter. So it was clear that after the repetition of epicenter observations that orbital epicenter is not a sufficient condition of a detection of such localized emission surpluses. So that was the report as last year with the five visits, one detection. And in this last part of my presentation, I will now present results from a medium-sized Hubble campaign that were carried out in the last observing period of Jupiter, so between November and last year and April this year, and present some results from this campaign. On the next slide, now slide 18, you see an overview of Europa's orbital parameters during this larger campaign that was carried out last year. And so every visit is color-coded, and the date is shown in the list below. And to the right, you see the observing geometry, and every rectangle is one exposure and shows where Europa was in its orbit around Jupiter as seen from the Earth or Hubble. And the size of the rectangle is kind of the corresponds to the exposure time of the respective exposure. And then another geometry is showing to the left, and this is where Europa was not in its orbit as seen from Earth, but in its orbit with respect to pericenter and epicenter, which precesses in like the observing geometry, so it's not identical. And what you can see is that we kind of really tried to cover evenly the parameter space of these two conditions through anomaly and orbital longitude of Europa to see all hemispheres and to see all stress conditions during like one orbit of Europa. And another difficulty is also that we have this variable plasma environment that certainly also affects the detectability of for all emissions at all, because you need the electrons, and this is another parameter that must be right to kind of schedule these observations. So we had 15 more observations, not always five orbits as we had in the first five visits, but between three and five orbits, or sometimes in eclipse, when Europa was in eclipse, then was only two orbits. But observations from 15 more days compared to 5 days before. And first I will talk about the analysis of the Lyman alpha images, which is kind of the best diagnostic to search for plume emissions, because the oxygen emissions are always present just from the global O2 atmosphere, whereas hydrogen emissions are not expected or only very low from a potential hydrogen corona. And on the next slide, 19, there's one example of an image triplet, so Lyman alpha and the two oxygen images from February this year. And what we did to kind of look for plume emissions, we looked at the LIM again, because all pixels on the disk are kind of hard to interpret, because we don't know the spatial variations of the albedo, for example, which can affect, because the reflected sunlight which is subtracted here in the images, assuming a homogeneous albedo, but this can affect, of course, all pixels on the disk. So we focus on the pixels just above the LIM, which are less affected by any surface reflected light or not, only weakly affected. And then we separate the LIM between like 1 Europa radii radius and 1.25 Europa radii in 20 bins here to get a better signal, and look if there's any inhomogeneity around the LIM in one of these 18 bins of 20 degrees. And that's how we kind of characterized the emission surplus in the first detection, and that's what we did for all the new images. And in this example, you can see, select the images, and then in the middle you see the brightness of these LIM bins, just as a function of the bin number. And for the uppermost panel, it's the Lyman alpha brightness. There is a certain Lyman alpha emission above zero, which might be a homogeneous hydrogen corona, but there is no localized emission.
Okay, this is Mike Boom. I want to ask a question.
Yes.
Yeah, what I noticed is that at near disk center, oxygen 1304 is much brighter than 1356. And this is surprising if it's electron impact. I mean, in fact, you wouldn't expect it to be brighter. You'd expect it the other way around. So have you got any ideas as to why you're seeing that enhancement near disk center?
Yeah, it's the so in these images, the signal to noise per pixel is really low. So it's hardly ever above one. So it's really one has to be very careful when interpreting these smaller scale structures across the disk. There are areas where the ratio of the two oxygen emissions differs from the standard of two, or let's say it's not between 1.5 and 2.5, but once you bin, like you take larger spatial bins, it always evens out mostly, and then it's really difficult. I mean, I don't want to interpret too much like in these smaller scales.
But it's obvious from the image that this feature at the center is real. And, of course, you can make it appear unreal by averaging over enough bins, but the point is that there's clearly a real enhancement at 1304 there, and there's no enhancement whatsoever in 1356, and the image is on the left.
Yeah, I mean, it's not impossible that we have locally or globally some contributions from other processes, like atomic oxygen column locally would, of course, produce more 1304. Just taking the global ratio sometimes requires additional atomic oxygen to O2. So it's not it's not given that it's only O2 and the ratio is between the oxygen emissions is 2 everywhere. But it's really difficult to like, yeah. I think it's one has to be careful interpreting smaller structures. But I will come to the ratio in a slide later on. Want a follow up question?
No,
that's
fine. Go ahead. Continue.
Okay. At the limb you can, in this case, at the limb you see a very nice consistent profile for the two oxygen emissions, and you don't see an emission surplus at Lyman Alpha. And then you can just take the brightest limb bin and compare it to the measurement in December 2012, which constrains like the H2O abundance to something like half of the value that was detected in the initial detection. But then again, it's probably better to really look for local emission surpluses above like a homogeneous limb brightness, which is on the order of 150 in this case here. So what I did for all images, I looked at the limb bins and then I subtracted the average limb brightness across all bins and compared the surpluses. And then we can go to the next slide, slide 20, where there are two plots of like this Lyman alpha emission surplus in the brightest bin. So I take the brightest bin, subtract the average brightness from all other limb bins, and did that for all 20 observations we have so far. And as it turns out, when you look, it's the light green that was the detection. In the first panel to the left, and second panel to the right, it's the same, just a different x-axis. It's just the observation number on the left, and to the right is the true anomaly. But staying to the left plot, you can see the December 2012 image doesn't even stand out here, because we do detect limb surpluses. But just looking at the uncertainties of the respective image and plotting the same things, now just the brightness by uncertainty, to kind of look at the sigma, it turns out that the December 2012 observation does really stand out, and all the other observations, so if you click on to the next step in slide 20, then two plots
appear. I have a question on this slide. If I look at the lower left panel, the noise as represented by sigma does not agree with what's shown in the upper right, upper left panel, which look at the errors on the individual points. The one you circled in the lower left panel should have a very large noise envelope on the surplus count at the top panel, but it does not. In fact, I see other things like bin 6 and 7, which have very large noise in the top panel, but no very nominal noise in the lower panel. So what's going on here?
There's no noise plotted in the lower panel. I just divide the brightness by the error bar.
What do you mean by sigma?
The upper panel shows like the deviation between the average and the brightest, and the uncertainty of the brightest bin. And then I divide the brightness by the uncertainty.
The signal-noise ratio is what you're showing there. Is that
correct? Kind of, yes. Yeah.
Well, why do you call it sigma? Okay, never mind. Thanks a lot.
So where was I? Anyway, all the other observations are surprisingly consistent at a low signal-to-noise. If you want, with nothing standing out except this one observation. So just in very simple, this means that we had no confirmation in these the last year's observations of the water vapor plumes. And so now I will focus more on the oxygen emissions and do like a more systematic analysis of the brightness and ratio and morphology of the oxygen images. Going on to the next slide, slide 21, which should show like a little image series, a small movie with different observations taken in different magnetospheric conditions, and to the left is a small sketch of the magnetic field orientation and the dipole field of Jupiter during this observation corresponding to the right. And what we can see, I don't know if it goes, maybe it stops after one cycle in your presentation, if it's on, I guess it should go on always cycling around through these images. And three things you can see here is that the brightness decreases with distance to the plasma sheet. So Europa, when it's in the plasma sheet center where the plasma density is highest, the emissions are brightest, as you would expect, then you somehow see that, if you want at least, that the emissions are more symmetric with respect to the magnetic field line that bisects Europa, which is plotted in solid red in the images, more symmetric to that, and not so much to like the north-south polar line. And then you also see that in these images, the hemisphere that faces the plasma sheet center is brighter, so that faces more plasma, the dense plasma sheet center is brighter than the opposite hemisphere. And since we have now quite a lot of images, we can look at these derived conditions in a more statistical way, and I'll look at two of them. So the brightness variations with Europa's distance to the plasma sheet center on slide 22, and here's a plot of the brightness of the 1356 image as a function of Europa's distance, like absolute distance in Jovian radii to the plasma sheet center. And you see a lot of scatter here between the different data points. But the overall trend, if you fit just an exponential decrease, which is often used for the vertical profile of the density in Jupiter's plasma sheet, you find a characteristic scale height of brightness decrease with distance, which is actually consistent with the scale height of the plasma density decrease derived from plasma measurements from Voyager and Galileo. And so this means you can see this structure of the plasma sheet in the observations, and this explains some of the brightness variations, not all of them, because you see this scatter, so you have also variations from visit to visit over weeks, and sometimes even within one visit, so over hours, you have strong deviations from this overall profile, which still matches the plasma density profile. And the second morphology characteristic on slide 23 is that you can try to show in a way that the morphology is correlated to the magnetic field orientation at the time of the observation. And therefore, I subdivided the disk in four quadrants. You can, to the upper left, you can see this little sketch, and then I compared the brightness in quadrants one, so upper left and lower right, to quadrants two, and plotted this here as a function of the projected orientation of the magnetic field onto Europa's disk. And whenever, so the center of the plot is kind of the magnetic field points downward, and then when the magnetic field points more to the left, the quadrants two, where the magnetic field line crosses through, are brighter, and then when the magnetic field line points more to the right, the areas one are brighter, which means to think that the emissions are really more like polar emissions, but polar with respect to this projected magnetic field line, so magnetic around the magnetic pole, so to say, and rather than near like the tangent points of the magnetic field lines, where you find the clearly brightest emissions at the neighboring moon Io. So it's really a strong difference, and suggesting a kind of general difference in the interaction of Europa with its environment. It might be just a different atmospheric density, which is about 1 to 2 orders slower at Europa compared to Io, and leading to a different plasma flow. But maybe it's also secondary effects, like the magnetic induction, that kind of changes the whole interaction scenario and leads to this difference in aurora morphology for the two moons. And on the next slide, I'll make one derivation for the atmosphere of Europa. You can, on the one hand, you can derive absolute abundances of the oxygen emissions from the brightnesses, but then there is this oxygen ratio, which tells you something about the ratio of atomic to molecular oxygen in the atmosphere. So looking at the, on slide 24, at the plot to the upper left, you can see, so one data point is one visit, one observation, plotted against the Europa's sub-observer longitude. On the left-hand side, you observe the leading hemisphere. On the right-hand side, more towards longitude 270, you observe the trailing hemisphere. And you see that pretty consistently, this oxygen line ratio is lower at on the trailing hemisphere near 270 orbital longitude than on the leading hemisphere. And this could, in principle, be just a difference in the properties of the exciting electrons, because different ratios just from electron excitation of O and O2 are expected for different temperatures of the colliding electrons. But it turns out that these higher ratios on the leading hemisphere can almost only be at any temperature, as you see in the plot below, explained by an almost pure O2 atmosphere, while on the trailing hemisphere you have lower ratios, so you kind of need a certain amount of atomic oxygen to get the ratio below 2. And we estimate about 5%, that's now the average over the whole hemisphere, 5% atomic oxygen, molecular oxygen on the trailing, and 1% or even lower atomic oxygen on the leading hemisphere, which is consistent with the interaction if we assume that electron impact is also the main force for like producing atomic oxygen, and that is of course more effective on the trailing hemisphere because it's the plasma upstream hemisphere, while on the downstream hemisphere, which is the leading hemisphere, electron impact is less effective and might not produce so much atomic oxygen, while the sputtering source might be not so of O2, depend not so much on the differ not so much between leading and trailing hemisphere. And so we've written this part up on the analysis of the oxygen images and submitted this to JGR. And I'll come now to the Hubble Science summary of the talk, and then after that I will just review slides on the future perspective. So Hubble observations are really a useful tool, or FUV observations, to explore Europa and its environment. They brought the detection of the O2 atmosphere and still provide the only tool to kind of measure, at least indirectly, the oxygen in Europa. And then we had one observation with a detection of coincident Lyman alpha at 1304 emission surpluses in a localized region, which is consistent with H2O abundance in this localized region. And we had a larger campaign in the last year, providing upper limits for H2O abundance, but no confirmation of the initial detection. And the problem, of course, is for these auroral emissions, we always need the plasma environment to be right, and the plasma environment can also change the whole interaction. It can change the global atmosphere, because, I mean, atmospheric sputtering by the plasma is the main loss source, so it can change the whole interaction system and allow or prevent then the detection of such a localized signal. But it turns really out that the brightness and morphology of the Austrian aurora can really use to probe the interaction and the atmosphere of Europa. And now just some ideas, because I mean this is a seminar about a future UV or UV visible infrared telescope for the Lyman Alpha observations here in our solar system. So we're observing Lyman Alpha at the Lyman Alpha wavelength. They're always so much affected by the geocorona, no matter what you do. Even on the night side, you have some geocoronal background, and this on the right here, slide 26, upper right, is a raw image from the SIF detector. And then, of course, you have the bright slit at Lyman Alpha and relatively bright slit that you can also see at the oxygen 13-04 line, which is less contaminated but also contaminated by geocorona. And this brings down, of course, the signal to noise for any observation at Lyman Alpha. And when you look at the plot below, named Lyman Alpha background, so on the day side it goes up to 30 kilorayleighs. On the night side, it's still somewhere between 4 and 6 kilorayleighs, just the geocorona. And what we're looking for at Europa is a 500 rayleigh localized over some pixels plume signal. And so this really hampers the detection a lot. So just imagining an 8-meter telescope at Lagrange Point 2, so outside the geocorona, we don't even need, the aperture, just without geocoronal contamination, that helps a lot. But just for this case, we would have a 10 times higher signal to noise for such a localized 500 rayleigh plume signal from Europa, which means in only 2 minutes we could have a 3 sigma detection, which might be very optimistic, but of course it would help a lot to have a UV telescope outside the geocorona for this case. And we will have smaller spectrographs, at least, very close to Europa. I mentioned the two missions in the beginning, and both the JUICE and the Europa multi-flyby missions, fortunately, will have a UV spectrograph on board, and these are built in a series of UVS instruments from Southwest Research here. You can see all of them in this family quadrant here, which many of you might have seen before. So I started with Rosetta Alice UV spectrograph that just measured the amount of water at the comet, and the two most recent are now the JUICE and Europa UVS instrument, which will be very similar. And slide 28 now. So JUICE UVS PI is Randy Gladstone, and Europa UVS is Kurt Rutherford from Southwest. And the Europa UVS, which I focus on here now because it's a talk about Europa, but it's similar to the JUICE UVS, will use three techniques here. Of course, we, just like Hubble, we look for UV emissions, but we will also, like the Lunar LRO LAMP instrument, look for reflected Lyman Alpha from the surface. And a third technique, which is possible in situ, is like that transmission spectra. So we have solar occultations, we have stellar occultations, which allows to look for O2, for water, and CO2, and other absorption signals in the atmosphere of the moon. Here are the technical details, so the spectral resolution of 0.6 nanometers and the spectral range from the EUV here up to 210 nanometers. And just to get an idea, this is like one example for observations during a flyby. So UVS can start early, can take global scans at higher or lower resolution, depending on if you want a higher signal or a better spatial resolution, to look for any localized inhomogeneities, to search for plumes, or to just characterize the global interaction by global scans. And then close by, of course, one can get higher resolution, a better signal of localized regions, whenever, of course, you can be limb pointing and the spacecraft is not nadir pointed. So this is was a small outlook that we will have sometime in the future more UV observations of the moons from ESA's Truth mission, from NASA's Europa mission, and I, of course, hope that there will be some UV telescope after Hubble that can be used as well then to look at Europa again. So these are my slides. Thank you very much for the attention, and I'm happy to take questions.
Great. Excellent, Lawrence. You already got quite a few questions, Kurt.
So this is Sean Domingo Goldman at Goddard. One question I had was, are you aware of any of the any potential correlation with the chaos terrain that Brittany Schmidt and colleagues have discovered on the surface of Europa? There's some potential correlation there with the plumes you've found, and that'd be quite interesting.
It's almost impossible to really point to one surface area as source region for what we saw there. It's basically one whole quadrant where it could be coming from behind the disk, from in front of the disk. So we cannot really say a lot. I did not know that this was coincident with the chaos region from the Schmidt paper. I have to check that again, but I don't think so, actually, that is like this anti-Jovian, near the anti-Jovian longitude. But I have to double check that.
Hi, this is Jennifer again. I was wondering if you are planning to do, or if anyone is planning to do further Hubble observations or searches for this, or are you finished with Hubble?
No, I'm not done with Hubble yet. I mean, to my knowledge, there's no other really sensitive technique to localize H2O abundances. Maybe people come up with something. I'd be very happy to have like an independent investigation. But I still think Hubble can be very useful. I mean, we understand the whole aurora system better and better now, and we kind of know exactly when to look. Really, it must be plasma sheet crossings. It's best really at maximum eastern or western elongation. That we definitely would like to try again with like a focused program, but we of course cannot. We don't know the variable nature of these plumes, and we cannot really say when they are active and if they are active often and how to find them. We characterize the aurora and can go from there and say we know from that when to look, and we would certainly like to look again with Hubble.
Okay, so are there any observations planned with Hubble, or are you just thinking you might propose again?
There are no observations planned. I mean, there's observations by another group, not us, observing Europa in front of Jupiter, looking for absorption signals from Jupiter Dayglow. They have done this a couple of times already. I think they had three or four smaller proposals in the last years to exactly look for localized absorption around the limb, but they have not published anything, so I don't know how successful this is. And they will take more observations now in winter. But our group does not have more observations this observation
cycle. Okay. All right, thanks. I really appreciate your talk. This has been very helpful, so thank you. Yes.
Yeah, and excellent. Do folks have other questions?
Yeah. This is Mike Moomba at NASA Goddard. I wanted to understand a little more what your evidence is for detection of O2. You don't have any optical signatures that could be assigned uniquely to O2, and so you were actually taking the ratio of 1356 to 1304 and interpreting that in terms of the cross sections that might produce the two lines from O2 versus O, and that gives you some way of comparing the two abundances. Is that correct?
Yes. So, you can try to find other I mean, other abundances of atomic to molecular oxygen or only atomic oxygen. And there has been a recent paper by Szymanski where they said it's only atomic oxygen. But if you use the right numbers for the plasma environment, if you calculate, which does in our group there is probable, the optical thicknesses, then you find out that there's, like, especially for these cases where the ratio is above 2, so there's 2 times more, 1356, there's just no other known process from laboratory results that can in any way in the Europa environment produce this signal than excitation of O2.
Let's explore that for a moment. For example, electron impact on H2O can produce H2 plus O through one channel and HNOH through a second one. So you're going to be producing both atomic oxygen and OH radicals by that first collision. And then, of course, from OH, you can dissociate that by the second electron collision and get atomic oxygen for a different channel. So, in fact, I think the electron cross-sections are not well understood for that second channel, but that leaves open the door as to whether you're not just seeing a scattering or dissociation of OH or some other oxygen-containing species other than O2 as a way of explaining this ratio difference. How do you distinguish the O2 from other potential sources of the atomic oxygen that might, in fact, be responsible for this difference?
It can, of course. I mean, I don't know the any results from laboratory results for like a hydroxyl, for example, for OH. But we need to have measurable abundances. You need also a species that is does not react with the surface too much. Does not react with like other radicals around. And so that's why O2 is kind of confirmed from the other side that whatever you try to model an atmosphere and you have a source rate, that's what you come up with, that O2 is the...
Well, but look, the quantum yield for destruction of water gives you H2 and O essentially 5% of the time, and H and OH 95%, maybe it's 10 to 1, roughly. So you clearly have two possibilities immediately. Without exploring the second one, which is actually the more likely dissociation mode, H plus OH, one really has to understand why you need to go on to a third case, which is molecular oxygen, or, might I add, peroxide, which is yet another way you can get H and O off the surface of Europa through sputtering, for example, or even vaporization.
I don't understand how you get considerable amount of OH in the atmosphere of Europa. I mean, O2 comes from radiolysis in the surface, and the O2 is released from the surface, and that's how you create this O2 atmosphere.
How do you get the water out?
You get there's a lot of water sputtered, but water freezes. Water doesn't build up a measurable surface near atmosphere.
Well, your suggestion was plumes of water, right?
Yeah, that's an immediate
electrons, and it produces OH radicals and atomic oxygen, and atomic hydrogen as well. So there's a simple way to get OH into the atmosphere of Europa, and once you then dissociate the OH by electron impact, you produce another source of oxygen atoms. Anyway, there are a number of avenues that one should explore before jumping to the conclusion that OH is being sublimed from the surface of the ice.
It's sputtered.
It could be so, and it could be that your suggestion is correct, but it needs to be one of several suggestions that are available, and then explain which is likely and which is not, and so on. It has to be a comparative analysis.
Does STIS have a longer wavelength channel in the UV?
I don't know.
Since there's only UV, you could look at those. Has that been done?
Yes, but I think the abundances are not high enough to see anything in longer wavelengths at the continual bands. But this can, I mean, you can observe, you can basically go from 100 nanometers up to 500 nanometers of spectral observation. This.
Yeah, and you can also look at, for prompt emission of OH at infrared wavelengths. As another way to attempt to detect the process which is producing water dissociation.
Do we have other questions? Other questions, folks?
Yeah, this is Avi at Goddard. Avi, so you presented a nice, you know, possibility for a future large space telescope to do this work, but that seems to be on the horizon for the 2030s, possibly after you've already had some of these flybys with near, near space spectrographs. And, of course, HST isn't going to last much longer. So I'm wondering if you have possibilities for doing these types of observations, you know, within the 2020s, between HST and some future large UV telescope.
I mean, they cannot be done from the ground, and I'm not aware of any near future space-based UV telescope. So I don't have plans in that sense.
Okay, and you haven't. Okay, just wondering if you had, you know, anything that you saw on the horizon, but it sounds like there's a big gap right now to do this type of work at all.
So
this is Jennifer from Goddard again. Will any of these flybys in the intermediate time, will they have the proper, will they have UV instrumentation?
The JUICE and Europa mission?
Yeah, the flybys that you mentioned that might come in the intermediate time.
They have a UV spectrograph, both missions, both Jupiter Moon missions have a UV spectrograph and will provide a higher resolution and with high sensitivity, depending, of course, on the distance and the actual setup, observations of exactly the same phenomena.
Okay, so that's great, right? That provides the Louvoir era. Okay.
We can hope
that
Hubble
will go on. Yeah, but those won't be coming until 2025 or 2030. I mean, you know, the question is, and they may be there only for a brief period of time, a brief flyby, so... You know, considering how infrequent the plumes actually seem to be erupting, you need some type of monitoring campaign.
Well, I would agree that if you can suggest one, a way of doing that, that would be wonderful.
Well,
yes.
Yeah. So obviously, I mean, you know that Stephen Reinhart and Dominic Benford have proposed UV balloons to do this type of work from high altitude balloon platforms. It depends what type of sensitivity you need, but you know, or of course you do a small scale UV telescope, but yeah, we need to really think carefully about how to propose this type of thing in the future, because this is going to be a severe gap, decade long gaps in the UV.
But just to counter that, the main problem with detecting atomic oxygen lines and hydrogen lines from the high altitude balloon platform is that the atmosphere itself is a very bright emitter in that region, and that's the advantage of Hubble. You're above most of that air globe, but you still have to worry about the high air globe, which I think Lawrence has already mentioned. So
yeah.
I don't think that...
I mean, even at the 600 kilometers of Hubble, it's problematic. So
Absolutely. Sure. No, I mean, you'd like to do something better, but depending on what type of aperture you could get and what altitude you could get, up to something like 50 kilometers, 45 kilometers in altitude, you might be able to get something. So, anyway, I don't know. This isn't my specialty either, but it should be considered carefully because this is going to be a huge gap. So.
Okay.
Further questions, guys? Further questions?
I think we're all
done. Let's
have a great talk. I really enjoyed it.
It was terrific. Let's thank everybody. Applause. Let's thank Lawrence again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye, everybody.
Perfect.